Welcome to the Clubhouse with Shane Bacon. I am your host, Shane Bacon, and I'm home. I finally got home. 3 weeks on the road with Fox. It was a lot of traveling. It was a lot of events, and it was a lot of fun. I mean, you know, I think back to Philly and the women's amateur, and it seems like it was a year ago. But you talk about some golf courses we got to see. Rolling Green was amazing. Scioto, of course, is everything you'd ever won. And then, you know, to end at Oakland is just unbelievable. And the U.S. Amateur, you know, the U.S. Amateur as a broadcaster might be the most fun event to cover all year. And both the men's and the women's, for that matter. Because, you know, you're getting players that are open to talk to you. They're excited to talk to you. They're excited to play golf. They hit driver on every hole. I'm not sure they've ever even heard of laying up in their entire lives. And you just get these storylines, and you start to follow certain players, and you see guys like Nick Carlson, and you get all excited because they're excited. You know, they're not tainted. Their game's not, you know, they haven't gone through seven instructors and four caddies and, you know, got bumped from the PGA Tour to the Web to the Asian Tour, played through the Hooters Tour. I mean, they just believe in themselves so much. And I think that was what was so much fun. So it was fun. I mean, a great 3 weeks. You know, this Fox broadcasting team, you know, Paul Azinger and Curtis Strange and, you know, Joe Buck, and, you know, you throw in names like Brad Faxon, and these guys are so much fun to just hang out with and be around. And I mean, you know, you get Scott McCarron 1 week and Steve Flesh the next, and they're just good guys. And I think that's one of the keys to the team. And I think that's why you're seeing, you know, a product this year that, you know, it really is next to none, is, you know, you've got really good people excited to broadcast golf. And if it's the U.S. Open or the U.S. Junior Amateur, I mean, the same intensity is being brought. So great 3 weeks, crazy 3 weeks. I mean, it really was. And just a reminder, if you want to get in touch with us, you can follow us on Twitter at the Clubhouse Pod. You can follow me at Shane Bacon. You can send in questions with the hashtag Clubhouse SP. Send an email to theclubhousewithshanebacon@gmail.com, which takes all of my breath. This week, Gil Hance is on the podcast talking Olympics. I mean, what a crazy couple of weeks on that golf course. I mean, that is an amazing, amazing piece of property. Gil is, you know, he was fired up. I mean, he's fired up about that golf course. I think it went as well as it could have gone, if not better. Didn't hear a single negative thing about it. Talked Olympics, talked course design, and really tried to ask him questions that everyday people wouldn't know, because I don't know a ton about course design. But I mean, we play golf courses, we go on vacations all the time, and I'm not sure we sometimes take a step back to understand what exactly is happening when we do it, or what exactly went into that golf course, you know, to allow us to go play it. So with that, let's do it. Gil is on the podcast. He gave us half an hour talking design. I know he's off doing a project that he can't talk about, so I didn't ask him about it, but he's got a lot of stuff going. He always has a lot of stuff going. He's one of the nicer guys that I've been able to work with over the couple of years at Fox. So Gil Hance up next. And I'm happy to welcome into the clubhouse a man that's fingerprint was a part of your golf viewing experience the last couple of weeks, Gil Hance. Gil, first things first, congrats on an amazing and successful experience in Rio. I didn't really hear, and this is true, I didn't hear a negative thing, even on social media, which I'm not sure that's even ever happened before. How was the experience for you down there?
Thanks for having me on, Shane. Yeah, I mean, maybe we broke social media. I don't know what happened. No, the experience was great. I mean, it literally could not have gone any better. I think, you know, sometimes when you draw up a plan and it comes out better than the plan, you know, we just were so fortunate with the outcomes, with the reception, with the weather, with the, you know, the way the golf course was prepared by the golf course superintendent. I mean, I think everything came together for those 2 weeks, and to have, you know, it's almost surreal that the winning scores on both the men and women's side were exactly the same. And you know, there's no way we could have drawn that up.
And what was your like 2 weeks of Olympics like? I mean, were you there the whole time?
Yes. Yeah, we were there. We left after the second round of the ladies tournament. We had some family stuff I had to get back for. And, but we got there about a week before the competition. I actually got to run and carry the Olympic torch in the torch relay, which was an absolute blast and quite an honor and very interesting experience. And then
what do you mean by interesting? Was it just bigger than you thought?
That and quicker. I mean, it's 200 meters, so you know, and I'm not that out of shape, so I probably covered it in about 30 seconds, and you're surrounded by security, and there's a truck in front of you that's filming the whole experience, and you know, somebody lights your torch, you run, and next thing you know, you're lighting somebody else's torch, and then you're getting back in the bus. So it was just faster, and I don't get nervous about much stuff, but I was pretty nervous about that, just thinking, good God, don't trip or fall or do anything stupid. And so, you know, you're kind of in the back of your mind just thinking, go, and next thing you know, it's over. But looking back on it, it was, you know, one of the greatest experiences of my life.
And first of all, you posted a picture on Instagram. What's your Instagram handle?
It is, I don't even know what it is. I think it's Gil_Hance.
So there you go. There's the plug. But you can check out the picture. I saw that picture of you running with it. But you mentioned the winning score. You mentioned, you know, the similarities between the way both the men and the women play the golf course. I wanted to ask you, simply put, was there a group that played the golf course the way you had designed it better? I mean, did the men play it better, the women play it better, or was it just kind of the same for both of them?
You know, it was interesting, Shane, and a lot of the sort of feedback we've gotten is that the course didn't favor a particular type of player. I mean, there are sometimes you either can be characterized or criticized for building a golf course that favors the bombers or this or that. And when you look at the leaderboard and the playing characteristics and the styles of sort of the six medalists, but not only just that, but the ones who are contending or close behind, they're kind of all over the board. And I think from an architect standpoint, that was really gratifying and exciting, that to know that we hadn't built a golf course that was going to favor one particular type of player. So, you know, I think we talked an awful lot early on about, a strong mental approach to the game, a lot of preparation. Nobody prepared any better than Justin Rose and his caddy, Mark Fulcher. They were out there early and often studying, looking at the golf course. Obviously Henrik Stenson has got, a keen eye for looking at a course and Kuchar. And then you saw, MB Park just putting lights out. I mean, I was looking at some of the putts she was making and thinking, they weren't easy putts. So I think, across the board, it was exciting to see all different types of players and different styles of games. But I think that the thing that was consistent across the board with them was that, the ones who prepared and really looked at the golf course and thought their way through it, I think were the ones who succeeded.
Yeah, and your schedule for the couple of weeks, I mean, you mentioned, running with the torch. Did you get to go watch some other sports? Did you get to take anything in?
Yeah, we did. We went to men's and women's gymnastics. We saw the women's, the finals for the team competition. So saw the American women performing there. We went to swimming. Saw Michael Phelps swim in a prelim for 200-meter butterfly. Went to water polo, basketball, beach volleyball. So, yeah, we covered a lot of sports.
did you miss any sports, apparently?
We did. When you or I are at a golf tournament or, we're covering the U.S. Open or, the Open Championship or the Masters or whatever it is, that's the biggest game in town. That's what everybody's focused on. That's what we're there for, what we're doing. But this was amazing in that golf was one of 29 different pieces that were all happening simultaneously. And I think the players in particular, they enjoyed being with the other athletes and going to see and how they prepared. And so that was one of the coolest aspects of this whole thing, is that golf wasn't the biggest show. I mean, it was the most important for us and for obviously anybody involved with golf, but there was all this other stuff happening in a city that, where there's always other things happening as well. So there was just almost too many things to try and accomplish during the stretch of the 2 weeks.
And I'm sure you got plenty of texts and emails from people. Did anybody send you a, great job or this has been amazing message that really stands out?
There were a lot of them, like you said, and I don't want to single anybody out, but one that was kind of personally really very interesting was when Tracy and I, when I was at Cornell in grad school, we lived in a professor's house, and basically we were caretakers for the house and the yard, et cetera, and we didn't have to pay rent. And so we got an email from the lady professor who lived there, and she's got to be in her 90s now, and saying she watched the golf and she was so proud and excited. And I mean, Tracy just burst in tears. We didn't even know that Dr. Hall was still alive, let alone following and watching and listening. So that was kind of a cool, out of the woodwork email we received.
And you, I know you've redesigned a ton of projects. I mean, I was looking at your website this morning, and I mean, the list is larger than I would have ever thought. And I know you do a ton of stuff and you never stop working. Where does this Olympic course rank in terms of maybe your proudest projects or, you know, your proudest moments in really golf architecture?
Well, you know, I think it'll have to rate up there. I mean, obviously, I'm hopeful we still have a long career ahead of us. I doubt it will be the best golf course we ever design as far as, you know, the piece of land and what we had to work with. But I cannot contemplate that there'll be another project that will have as much visibility and as much attention paid to it as this one. And I mean, just the entire story was pretty much told out through television with the documentary and just, you know, all the accounts of the difficulties of getting it built. And then it was built. And then now obviously chronicling of the championship. And, you know, I think if golf continues to be a part of the Olympics, which I think everyone's feeling much better about now than we did maybe 3 weeks ago, you know, long-term, did this course of just providing the stage. I mean, obviously I don't want to get too self-important. The players were the story and they performed, they played on this course, but you know, did the course somehow contribute to that? So I don't know if there'll ever be a more important golf course that we'll be involved with, but I'm hopeful that, you know, from a design standpoint, we still have better work ahead of us.
Yeah. And two kind of outside factors I want to talk about this project, then we'll move on. But the first things first, and this is just a complete layman's question about course design. I know you've got the black course going at Streamsong that's set to open in 2017, the Olympic golf course. We saw a lot of the animals around. There were alligators in these waters. When you're doing a project that has something like that around, what are the parameters you take to make sure that nobody runs into one of those things when they're going through the design process?
Really not much you can do. I mean, I've purchased a really nice set of snake boots now, so I've learned. You know, Bill Coore told me that, you know, Streamsong, they ran into a few snakes out there, and you know, walked properties in Nebraska and California where, you know, they're around, and thankfully never been bit. But I think that's really the main precaution, and just be aware. You know, just kind of be aware of what's around you. Understand that, you know, you're in their territory, and you have to be respectful of what they, and don't do anything crazy like trying to poke them with a golf club. I couldn't believe Henrik was out there doing that. I was like, that was interesting.
Yeah, you know, I have a theory on these things. Like you said, you're in their land. You're messing with where they live. They're at the advantage. It's like, I'm not going near that guy. And Henrik was taking it on for sure. He's had a great year. It's not no reason to mess with this season, you know?
I know.
You have snakes, you have alligators, you have these kind of outside agencies. And of course, the one that got the biggest press up into the Olympics, and then really nobody really talked about it, was Zika. I mean, this was the big thing. Zika. You spread it everywhere. Did you guys run into any problems with that?
No, not that we know. I mean, everybody's come home, you know, a little bit of stomach issues, but nothing. Nobody's gotten sick. And, you know, touch wood, I think we're all clear from that standpoint. I don't know. I didn't speak to anybody down there who had any issues. And, you know, one of the telling things as well was that, you know, Neil Cleverly, the golf course superintendent, He has not contracted it. Nobody on his 40-person crew contracted it, even through the height of the, you know, the season. So I think the golf course in and of itself, as we all saw, the wind blows a lot there. It's not to say that they're not around, but I don't, you know, hopefully we don't all of a sudden in a month from now hear a bunch of reports about Zika being contracted down there. But we took precautions. We put bug spray on, but nobody really had any issues. I can't even think that I saw maybe one or two mosquitoes while I was there.
Yeah, and did the players come over to you at all and say, way to go, this has been amazing? I mean, did you get some feedback from them as well?
Yeah, we did. You know, sometimes, you know, you never know where you stand with the guys. If they shoot 76, their opinion might be different than if they just shot 63. But, now, beforehand, in particular, the guys are very chatty about the course, very impressed, very happy. I mean, Padraig Harrington said some things that, you know, certainly made me blush. He was extremely complimentary about the golf course. I heard, you know, that Ben Ahn said it was his favorite golf course he'd ever been on. You know, a few of the women said similar things. So it was the feedback from the players was great. The media was great. I mean, I talked to Doug Ferguson for a little while from the AP, and you know, he talked about one of the things that, and never really struck me, but when he put it in the context, he said, listen, you know, the other thing people haven't really focused on is you guys had to get this right. You didn't have time to go back and to have a do-over, or, you know, the test event was so close to the tournament. There was no time to go back and fix something that was wrong or that could have been a glaring issue. And I think, you know, obviously I'm proud of the work that Jim Wagner and I did, and, you know, Amy Alcott consulting on it, and then all the guys in the field, you know, Neil, Ben, and Kyle in particular. So that struck me because I never really thought about it. But, yeah, it was a good week. A lot of real positive feedback, and certainly also a lot of positive feedback and credit to the maintenance staff, because they had it in terrific shape.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned, I mean, you have a deadline. There is a deadline for this golf course that has to be ready at a certain time. If Streamsong Black, for instance, you know, goes a month past its date, I mean, you're not going to be happy about that, but it's not the end of the world. Did you have more people working on this simply because there was a deadline you knew you had to hit?
No, it actually seemed like we had less people working on this. You know, the first year was really slow, and now with hindsight and, you know, separation, I think it was a good thing, because we were able to, as we call it, sort of put things into the cooling off stage and just let them sit for a while, and then go back and revisit and rethink. And like I mentioned, the guys who are on site are all very talented and knowledgeable and thoughtful. And I think the more time we had to let the golf holes, you know, go through a gestation period, I think ultimately that helped us come up with a product that was ready to go when it needed to be.
Yeah, and lastly about the course, you know, and people have asked this question, so I just wanted to ask you and get your thoughts. I mean, where do you see the golf course in 5 years? Because, you know, it doesn't seem like Rio's got an enormous golfing population, but I think the benefit to it is they did see this, you know, on the grand stage for 2 weeks, and I'm assuming that people there would want to go play this. So, you know, where do you see the Olympic golf course in, say, 5 years?
Well, I'm hopeful that it, you know, two parts. Hopefully, first and foremost, that it's successful operationally and from a legacy standpoint. I mean, we intentionally made the course to be playable. And I talked to a few riders who played it on Monday. Had a little bit of an outing out there for the media and some guests, and they had a ball. They said it was terrific. So hopefully the people in Rio who are invested in golf already, or members of clubs or, you know, active golfers will at least play there a couple times a month. I think that there's an expat population that really doesn't have any access to the private clubs, that, you know, there might be more golfers in Rio that are kind of hiding, for lack of a better way to phrase it. That'll be part of it. And then hopefully people from around Brazil who are interested in golf will come and play it. I'm not sure about the tourist aspect, whether you're going to bring your clubs all the way down there to play one round, but maybe. And then I think on the other end, hopefully they'll continue to host championships. I think, you know, the Brazil Open will be there later this year. You know, it might be a great place to have a, you know, Latin American amateur, you know, a bigger stage, perhaps a President's Cup at some point in time. But I think if the golf course can still stay in the golfing public's eye as a worthy championship venue, and, you know, the Brazilians can use it to help grow the game and understand it and play it. You know, I think the last 2 weeks certainly didn't hurt in any way, shape or form to sort of set it up for success. And I'm hoping, you know, that the powers that be that are going to start running it soon will take advantage of that.
Okay, so now to design questions. So a couple of questions just because I'm interested in stuff like this, because, I mean, I play a lot of golf, and I sometimes forget to take a step back and understand the process that went into it. From the time you get a bid on a golf course to opening day, what's the normal time period from those two moments?
You know, two and a half years. I think unless you're in a place with extreme permitting restrictions, you're probably 6 months for design and permitting. You know, probably a year for construction, and then, you know, 6 months to a year for growing. And so I think that's a good typical window. Obviously, it can be accelerated or it can take a lot longer based on outside factors.
Yeah, what's the longest it's taken you to build a golf course? Is there one that sticks out that seemed like it took a lot longer?
Rio. I mean, it, you know, from we were selected in 2012, and it, you know, it wasn't finished until early 2015. So that was, you know, three plus years window. I mean, there are some that just never get off the ground, but I think that's probably the longest we've, you know, from sort of conception to start that actually happened. I mean, some you'll go through the process and they just evaporate for one reason or another. Yeah, we've been consulting, working on a project in China now for about 2.5 years, and we haven't turned any ground. So that'll, if that ever gets built, that'll probably be the one.
Yeah, and how long did it take you to refine this process? I mean, you started your business in 1993, I saw. Is that correct?
Yeah, you were probably, what, 2 at that time?
Hey, now, I was like 9. I was 9 years old. Right. I'd barely taken the game up, but I was getting into it.
Good. No, I was complimenting you, how young you are. So 93. So I worked for Tom Doak for 4 years. I graduated from Cornell in 89 and went to work for Tom, and then started my own company in 93. Jim Wagner joined me in 95. So we've been partners for 20 years now. And, as a young architect, you pretty much cut your teeth on renovation, restoration, because not many people are willing to entrust you with the budget or a piece of land to build a new golf course. So, I mean, it took probably 4 or 5 years before we even got our first opportunity to do that. And yeah, you learn obviously, and you get better at it, and you understand. I think one of the things that, you know, architects like Bill and Ben, Corin Crenshaw, are great at is that, you know, they're able to sort of suss out whether a project has obviously potential to be great, number one, but also sort of if the timeline will fit within, you know, the schedule that they have. And I think we're getting better at that.
And you've already mentioned Tom Doak, you mentioned Bill and Ben as well. I mean, is the design community close? I mean, do you reach out to them ever about anything like, hey, I've got this place, I have a question, or is it more just you do your thing, I'll do mine, and we respect each other for what we do?
There's a little bit of both. I mean, I'm very close with Bill Coor, so we can certainly talk about a lot of things. And then we've got a group of younger guys that, you know, Kyle Franz, who's been an associate of ours, worked with us, is starting to do his own stuff, and he does great work. And you know, I trust all the guys that we work with on our team. I'm good friends with Jim Urbina, Ian Andrew from Canada. So yeah, I'd say there's 5 or 6 guys that, you know, we all feel pretty comfortable sharing ideas, thoughts, questions. I'm always happy to mentor some of the younger guys, you know, on business, like, you know, what is your standard contract look like? What is your, you know, when you go to a club and deal with, so sort of nuts and bolts, practical business stuff, as well as, you know, design philosophy.
Yeah. And is the rule to be an elite designer that you have to be a really nice person? Because you're a really nice guy, and Bill Coor might be the nicest person I've ever met. I mean, is there anybody out there where you're like, that guy's just a jerk? Because it seems like everybody's so nice.
I wouldn't tell you if I was. it's an interesting, I mean, I think, you know, we're all sort of like-minded individuals, and maybe our personalities would gravitate towards each other a little bit more, but yeah, I mean, it, as in any field, you're going to run the full gamut of different personalities, and some of them will be pretty strong, and some certainly will be opinionated, and there's no shortage of egos in our business, including me.
Well, I haven't seen it yet. I've known you for now a year and a half, 2 years now. But, you know, you're doing a redesign like the Country Club at Brookline, for instance, that held the U.S. Amateur. How much influence does the USGA have? Do they give you their notes, or do you give them your notes and they kind of say that's good or not?
Yeah, it usually starts with us because, I mean, first and foremost, you're trying to accomplish a project that's going to benefit the membership. Yeah, I mean, you could do all this stuff for a championship, and if it makes the course worse or less enjoyable for the membership, then you really haven't accomplished anything, because they're ultimately the ones who employ you and the ones that you've got to have a long-term relationship with. So I think we always come from the premise of, okay, this is a club that is has hosted in the past national championships, has a desire to continue to host national championships. What do we need to do to sort of marry the two interests, and are they mutually exclusive? Hopefully they're not. And then once we come up with a plan that we think serves both needs, then we ask, then the USGA comes in and reviews and says, yeah, this makes sense. Or, hey, you know, a lot of what they comment on, there's design stuff, but they also comment an awful lot about sort of outside the ropes and infrastructural needs, and hey, we've got to fit a structure in here, and is there any way, you know, if you're pinching all the players to leave this green in this direction, that's not going to work out that great. So there are logistical aspects, like you and I saw at Oakmont, you know, in Chambers, is sort of how things that, you know, that need to happen when the show comes to town, that don't always take precedence, or never, I take that back, never take precedence over a good design. But if there's a way to sort of marry the two together, I think the USGA and the PGA and, you know, anybody that's running a championship of that scale is interested in talking about.
And, you know, you in particular, I mean, the way you design golf courses, and I, you know, I played Castle Stewart, which I just want to say, not to compliment you, but I mean, I absolutely love that place. And I watched the Olympics. You know, both of those golf courses end on a par five. Do you have a little design thing you like to do, a drivable par four, a short par three? I mean, are there little things that you like to put into every course you design, or is it more what the land gives you?
Well, I think it's a combination of the two. Yeah, it's not like a template where we have to have this, but, you know, we think that, you know, an interesting and fun golf course is going to give you these types of experiences, you know, short par three, short par fours, variety of different challenges. And if we can weave them into the design, we're always going to strive to do that. I think what makes those holes unique and interesting is that if we then utilize the assets of the land, kind of whatever the land will give us to create, hopefully a different type of short par four or a different type of short par three or, you know, those sorts of things. I think when you're talking about championships, I'm a big believer in sort of finishing on a positive note. I think there was a lot of discussion about that with the Olympics. Instead of, you know, you and I might understand and appreciate the subtleties and the nuances of guys and girls struggling and grinding to you know, make pars, et cetera. But especially for the Olympics, that's a different stage and a different set of eyeballs watching it. And it was important to us to try and create a finish where positive golf, exciting golf was going to carry the day as opposed to, you know, struggling to just get it in the house or relying on somebody to double bogey a hole, right, so that you might step in the back door. So I think that those are aspects of design that we always try to bring to our golf courses, but there's no sort of set template, or I think it's a coincidence that 18 is a par five on those. I wouldn't say we always try to end with a par five, but it just happened to work out that way on those two courses.
Yeah. And when I visited Castle Stewart, we did a little tour of it. And one of the things that stuck out of my mind and something that I had no idea about was, and you can correct me if this is incorrect, but, you know, we were told that Bannon Dunes was an influencer into the idea of it. And, you know, this is a place in Scotland, in the Highlands. And, you know, to hear Bannon Dunes influence that was interesting. And, you know, one of the sentences that stuck out of my head was, you know, we're in the entertainment business. And when you think about that, a public golf course in Scotland where it's mostly driven by tourism, you know, it's a golf course that has fairly wide fairways and greens that you can hit, you know, with a shot. I mean, you might not be close, but you'll be on the green. I mean, do you see golf design going that way where the course can be more playable because these people are forking over money and trying to have a good time? And as you mentioned, trying to walk off on a positive note?
I think it should be. I think it's something we should be striving for. And obviously, you know, Castle Stewart, we had the good fortune of working alongside from a design standpoint, but also as an owner, Mark Parson. And Mark, you know, has a wonderful set of ideals and thoughts as it comes to design. It was something that Jim Wagner and I were eager to embrace. I mean, the two words he always used and we always talked about was keeping the golfer hopeful and engaged. You know, if you're hopeful and you feel like you can hit a shot, then you're going to be excited. You're going to be happy. And if you're engaged in the golf hole, it means you're not in your pocket. You haven't just sculled a ball in the beach, or you're not looking for lost balls all over the place. And I think that if we can approach design with concepts where, you know, a lot of people don't talk about this from the context of, if you can design a golf course that is playable for the average golfer, and yet the level of precision to score on that golf course is such that a really good golfer is challenged to do so, then you've hit the grand slam right there. So, I mean, people talk about playability, but then they don't talk a lot about scoring and the different levels of precision for, if I'm just going to go out and play a golf course, all right, that's a whole different thought process of somebody like you, who's a good player, is you're going out and you're actually trying to post a score, or you're playing in a match that is going to be competitive. And I think that, you know, what we tried to do, and one of the things, the best takeaways from our standpoint from the Olympic golf course, is we think we accomplished that. Going into the Olympics, we didn't know whether angles were dead for that class of player. You know, golfers, guys hit it so far and so straight. I mean, did it matter that, you know, we set up and we put a hole location where, you know, if you're not coming to this hole location from the left side of the fairway, you're going to really struggle to, you know, to make a birdie. And it turned out to be true. I mean, they still are important, yet we've given a 65-yard wide swath of ground for somebody like me to play through, and a big green where on any day-to-day setup, we can put the pin right in the middle of the green, and I don't have to go hunting for it behind a bunker or behind a mound or with a sharp fall off to the side of it. Yet when the big boys show up or good players play, you have the flexibility within that setup to set it up as difficult as possible so that the level of precision to actually post a score on it is a requirement that challenges that class of player. So I think, you know, one of the lessons we learned at Castle Stewart through Mark and discussion was, yes, we need to build something that is playable and fun and friendly for, as Mike Kaiser refers to them, the retail golfer. Yet we also have had aspirations there to host the Scottish Open, which they've done. We had the Olympic course hosting the Olympics. And if we can get a golf course that'll handle both of those constituencies, then I think, you know, that's we've done the best we possibly can with that course.
Yeah, and you know, it seemed like we went through a phase where it was all about building tough golf courses. And I almost feel like the modern designer, I mean, we mentioned, you know, Doak and Cor Crenshaw and you is, you know, it does seem like some of the courses that I've played that have opened the last 5-6 years, you know, they don't beat you up as much. And I think, you know, if we're talking about quote unquote growing the game, you know, part of growing the game is to go out there and do something successful. You know, you don't want to go shoot 105. You know, you want to shoot 95. You know, you want to shoot a number where you're, you know, proud of that scorecard. So, I mean, to you guys and your guys' credit, I mean, that's impressive that you can find a way to couple that with a place, like you said, you know, that hosts the Scottish Open that sees Phil Mickelson win on it.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's always been the toughest part of our business. How do you design a golf course playable for a 36 handicapper? And of course, where Phil Mickelson is going to, you know, not shoot 54.
Right.
So I think it's one of those things where, you know, I don't know. I obviously, I think, you know, the roots of what Bill and Ben and Tom and we are trying for are kind of all stem from the traditional aspects of the game, the links, the original links, the great old designers. And they somehow found that, that sweet spot for doing it. And, you know, I'm hopeful that we've found that sweet spot as well, and we can, you know, obviously keep building courses like that, and maybe they serve as something that other designers will emulate, and if we can kind of move golf in that direction where it's like you said, it's more friendly and it's more encouraging as opposed to disappointing, I think then that can only be good for golf.
Okay, so I'm going to get you some quick hit questions, then I'm going to get you out of here because I know you're of course you're working again. I'm not sure you take vacations, but first things first. How many projects do you have going right this second?
You know, it's different. It's hard to say because, you know, we only count really ones under construction because they're the ones that take the most of your time. So right now we have zero under construction, but by September 19th we will have 3 under construction.
That's not too far away.
It's
like,
no,
it's like 2 weeks.
But we've got a lot of stuff in planning.
What's the best modern golf course design, in your opinion, on the planet? And you can say something you've done. Nobody's going to make fun of you.
Sandhills. Sandhills is just so good and so perfectly crafted to that piece of land. And all the details are there, and they're right. It's, yeah, I mean, it's what we should all be aspiring to try and do.
Best hole you've ever designed.
Wow. You know, and it's obviously close. And I think 16 at the Olympic course could be the best course, the best hole we've designed. I think it proved to be as strategic as we had hoped for, and is interesting for a 305-yard hole to have the scoring swings and the interest and the character. We spent a lot of time thinking about that one, and I think it really turned out well.
If you could play a round of golf at one course before you die, what would it be?
The old course.
What's a course on your bucket list you've yet to play?
Chicago Golf Club.
Nice. That's a good one. I think David Faye said the same thing. Did they not allow Fox people to go there, apparently?
<That's>,
you need to talk to him about it.
I haven't played golf anywhere in Chicago. It's the one sort of, you know, gaping spot in my resume where I haven't been to Shore Acres. I haven't been to Old Elm. I haven't been to any courses in Chicago. So at some point in time, we'll just have to take that vacation you're talking about and maybe go to a Cubs game in Wrigley. I've never been to Wrigley, and go play Chicago Golf Club if I can get on.
I need to talk to our producer, Mark Loomis, about setting all this up. If you were allowed to collaborate with one designer out there, who would it be?
Bill Coor.
And if you look at an old, you know, architect, somebody that's not even around anymore, who's the person that you look up to the most that designed golf courses?
Alistair McKenzie, I think, is the first guy to get sort of the strategy and marry that with the beautiful landscape.
I'm trying to play Alistair McKenzie has designed, you know, some of the best golf courses in the world. I'm trying my hardest to go do a Pasatiempo trip in the next couple of weeks. Have you played Pasatiempo?
I have. Yeah, it's fantastic. It's so much fun. And the work that Tom Doak and Jim Urbina, those guys did out there, is fantastic. It's great, great restoration.
Well, I appreciate you coming on. I know you're busy. I know you've got stuff going on. Any updates on some of your projects that are coming up? I mean, any ones that are opening up in the next year or so?
Yeah, actually, we've got Mossy Oak, a new club down in West Point, Mississippi, opens September 2nd for sort of limited founders play. We're excited about that. It's a beautiful piece of ground. And the growing at Stream Song Black is cranking. Rusty Mercer, the superintendent, says, you know, the grass is really moving along. So we're still sometime in 2017, but maybe sooner in 2017 than we originally thought. And the South Course at Los Angeles Country Club opened beginning of August, and members seem really, really happy and excited with what we were able to do out there. You know, working with Jeff Shackelford and Jim Wagner and I, it was a fun project, 6,400 yards. And I'm hearing even from the good players at the club that it's, you know, it gives them that little bit of challenge that the old South Course didn't have.
Well, Gil, I appreciate it. Have a great rest of your year, and congratulations again on the Olympic golf course. It was amazing.
Shane, thanks for asking me on. This is fun. Anytime. Happy to do it, man.
And that'll do it for this week, the Clubhouse Pod. Sorry about no pod last week. Like I said, it was traveling. It was a little too crazy, but we'll get back into it. I got a guest on Thursday that's going to come on for next week, and we're going to roll out a few more. I will be at the Top Golf in Las Vegas on Monday. I will be at the Top Golf in Scottsdale the Saturday after. I think that's the 11th? Sure. Let's just say the 11th. Make sure you're looking up Top Golf Tour. It's going really well so far. We're excited about it. And of course, I'll be at the finals November 12th in Las Vegas as well. Two Vegas trips in 2 months. Man, I gotta start drinking some water. Okay, that'll do it. We'll see you next week.